Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Heart of Healthcare podcast. I'm Hallie Tecco.
And I'm Steve Krause. And every Monday, we bring you the latest in healthcare innovation as we sit down with entrepreneurs and industry experts.
So buckle up and join us as we figure out how to improve healthcare for all. Hi, Steve. Happy April.
Ah, happy April to you, Hallie. We're right in the middle of March Madness, so I feel like we're kind of like straddling the 2 months. But
okay, happy.
I'm a big basketball fan, so happy.
I didn't even know it was basketball season. I'm embarrassed.
Well, we know we have diverse perspectives on this one.
I know it's baseball season though, because family big fans. So I know that. Yeah.
Who's your team? Who's your family's team?
So my husband's a Yankees fan, and we call them, because my son would say when he was littler, the Ankies. So
we're the
Ankies family.
And I'm a Red Sox fan. So listen, we got good polarity here. I like that.
Yes. Great. Well, so listeners, this is Steve and I's monthly episode together where we talk about the news that hit our inboxes that we saw over the last 30 days that we wanted to discuss. And if you have any ideas or topics for us, you can reach out to us and we'd love to chat about what's on your mind in digital health.
Yeah. Lots to talk about this month, huh, Hallie? Jeez.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And we're trying to keep it to six, but it is hard. So let's start with what is perhaps the most polarizing study to come out in the last 30 days, which was the report by the Peterson Health Technology Institute, which is upsetting a lot of folks in the digital health space. So basically, they looked at diabetes monitoring apps, including some big ones like Livongo, Onduo, Vita Health, Virta Health, Omada, and concluded that they do not deliver meaningful clinical benefits and actually result in increased healthcare spending. And the report highlighted one promising solution out of the eight that were evaluated, which is Virta Health. But the Virta team is quite pleased with the report. Everybody else is super upset about it. What are your thoughts on the study?
You and I have been in this industry a long time, and I'm actually super excited that a report like this was put out. I know it's potentially could be challenging for not just the diabetes management companies, but I assume they're going to put out a report on, you know, mental health and then MSK, and I assume the list is going to go from there. But I think that we need to hold ourselves to high bar if we're trying to change the industry, right? And I think one of the most challenging things has been to measure quality in healthcare for a long time, for digital health companies, as well as for just like your average doctor, right? And so I know there's a bit of a kerfuffle, as you said, about this report, and there's probably some downstream consequences in terms of companies' ability to raise or what have you. But I overall think it's a good thing. I think we should be celebrating this. Of course, we need to really look at the methodology and how each company was measured. But it feels when you read the report that they're kind of holding the companies to a high standard, as they should. Now, what I would say is I don't think this is a point in time. And so like we should be measuring these companies year over year on how they're progressing in terms of managing their outcomes. So I don't think this should be the be all end all, like diabetes management applications are not, you know, worth anything. I don't think that's the case. I think, as I tell all of my companies, you have to have a roadmap for how you're going to measure outcomes. And at first you can't do the level of randomized controlled trial that I think the Peterson report is ultimately looking for, right? You're going to have to do case studies with your customers. Probably you're going to have to do your own reported outcomes first, what you hope to see, case studies with your customers. Then maybe, you know, you're able to get some kind of academic to, you know, from a public health school to do a study, right? And then ultimately, maybe you can do a true randomized controlled trial. And I think this is a crawl, walk, run. And I think we should look at it as this is an organization which is seems to be nonpartisan and seems to be trying to push the ball forward in terms of how we measure success. So I think, by the way, there's some positives which we should talk about in this report. But I think overall, we as an industry should be celebrating this. And even though it's not all roses, we should be welcoming this and we should be continuing to push the ball forward because we do all want to improve healthcare. And so you need to actually drive outcome improvement in order to do that.
Yeah. So, but do you think that digital health solutions should be held to kind of all three standards, lower costs, better outcomes, better access? Or yeah. Is it okay if they just...
Well, let me take a step back. Yeah. I think actually I was reading some, you know, in preparing for this, you and I try to read up and see what people are saying and also read the report. And I saw a quote by Matt Holt, I think it was on Twitter, where he basically said, like, listen, the as-is healthcare system probably wouldn't pass the marks on this report.
Yes. Not the control, though? Wasn't the control looking at traditional care?
No, but he wasn't talking about diabetes management. He's just talking about healthcare in general. Like, you know, for the average healthcare that we talked about this on our last podcast, yeah. right? The average yeah. healthcare that America experiences is not great. So, yes, I think we should hold our industry to sort of that bar, those three, the trifecta, if you will, right, that you just mentioned. And I think we should also, you know, measure the as-is system. And by the way, the as-is system, for the most part, falls down.
Yeah. Well, and there's some concern that the report only looked at 8 solutions, but really made some generalized conclusions. And so like the Digital Therapeutic Alliance, they wrote a really, I think, fair rebuttal saying that, hey, that's misleading. Like, we can't just look at 8 solutions and put a mark on the entire industry. And we do have to consider what this means. If an employer reads that, if a buyer is reading this report, they might dismiss every digital therapeutic for diabetes. And maybe that's unfair because this report really is talking about those 8 specific solutions.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I'm interested to see what the fallout is here is and how, to your point, are employers going to use this as a way to not make a decision, right? Not choose a solution, drive down the price of that solution, what they're willing to pay, right? And at least to try to slightly improve the outcome to cost ratio. Or is it just the fact that, frankly, and we're going to talk about this in one of the stories we're going to talk about next, like, it's, you know, virtual care is kind of here. And it's a tool that you have in your toolkit as an employer or as an insurer. It's not the end all be all. But my guess is also that large employers need to have a digital diabetes management solution, even if it doesn't meet the gold standard randomized controlled trial outcomes right now. That's my guess, but we'll see. The one thing I would note, Hallie, is actually it's not all doom and gloom. It did report out 2 things. You mentioned one, which is that nutritional ketosis, which was a solution like Virta applies, that it did show benefit there. It also noted that patients with high A1C greater than 9 and starting insulin, that these applications really helped. And by the way, like, that's actually a really interesting finding. That put aside the ketosis point, which we can talk about. The patients who have high A1C who are also using insulin, like, that's not a small market in America. Yeah. Like, that's a really large market in and of itself. Like, 10 years ago, if you told us that we could start a company, if we imagined it, you and I, if we were entrepreneurs and said, oh my God, we're going to start an application, a chronic care management software company that's going to treat insulin dependent high A1C patients, like, that's a very large TAM still in America. So it wasn't like nothing works. It was like some things work. And I think my hope is that the Peterson Institution and others are going to keep an open mind about over time, seeing if other applications can truly, you know, bend the cost curve, improve quality, and also, you know, increase access, to your point.
Yeah. Well, let's see if we can get someone from the Peterson Health Technology Institute on the podcast, maybe also someone from the Digital Therapeutics Alliance, because I think that there's just so much more to dive into here.
That would be an amazing podcast. We got to do that.
Yeah.
All right. So what I noted, and Hallie, I know this is near and dear to your heart, is Rock Health, which you were the founder of, released their annual consumer engagement and digital health survey this past couple weeks. And actually, it relates a lot to these companies. You know, I thought the really interesting thing they did, their 2023 survey of 8,000 consumers, which is a lot, that's a large N, on digital health adoption, showed that, you know, as they say, we're in a new era of consumer engagement. And frankly, that the industry has reached a maturity point, which is so great to see. They noted that adoption of virtual care has steadied and is hovering around 75% for the past year. And so I thought that was interesting. I'm curious, what were some of your takeaways from this survey?
Yeah, it's I just love seeing these reports. They are getting better and better every year. Megan is doing a wonderful job leading the research team. Malay really created this report, I think it was in 2014, and really wanted to get a representative sample of Americans and how they view digital health and how they are adopting different tools. And it's so cool now to have this longitudinal data. There's a lot to unpack here. Perhaps thinking about the virtual care and really reaching that maturity there, where would this be if we didn't have COVID, right? Like COVID was that avalanche that we needed to push adoption on both sides, help providers get over the hump and concerns so that now it's normal and they're okay with it. And patients in the same way. Like, I'm so grateful that we are here where we're at because it has increased access to care. It's benefited me personally. It's made my life a lot easier to be able to talk to providers virtually. But where would we be? It's just a thought, a question.
That's why I love doing this with you. It's like, you know, we have some perspective and, you know, we just talked about some of the challenges of our industry, right? But the fact that we're now measuring outcomes for an industry that didn't exist a decade or so ago is just amazing. Yeah. And your point, I always say COVID shifted our industry forward 2 decades in 2 years. And obviously tragic episode, but one of the bright spots, if you will, from COVID was people are now using this. Like 75% of people said they use virtual, are comfortable using virtual care. And by the way, I think 86% said they used it in the last year. I mean, that's shocking compared to where we were 5 years ago, right? So I thought the interesting thing for me, I agree, a lot to unpack. And I know you've got some perspective on one of the insights here, but the one that was the most interesting to me, which was really counterintuitive, is that the report found that interestingly and surprisingly, older patients, and I think they said 65 plus, maybe even 75 plus, were 2x more comfortable sharing their health data and via virtual care, I believe, with clinicians than younger patients. And literally the generation that uses TikTok and uses Instagram, and frankly, whether they know or not, are sharing their data all over the internet. That didn't make sense to me. Was that surprising to you? And like, shocking. What do you make of that?
I know. I have no idea. It is also shocking because when I think about like my parents who are in their late 70s and how afraid they are to even do a genetic test because they don't want that data in the hands of someone who's malicious, it's shocking to me, not just that the younger people who are sharing their entire lives online are unwilling to share or are less comfortable sharing health data, but that the older generation is actually more willing given how cagey they tend to be with any of their personal data.
Yeah. I mean, I know I love my father, but it's like, you know, whenever he calls me up about a software application question, I'm like, oh my God, this is going to be like tech support for hours. Right. And so the fact that, I mean, this is like a statistically significant sample that Rock Health has now put together. I don't get it. And I don't think this is a trend, but I'd be interested to see this over time, because if that's true, there's a little bit of concern about that, because presumably the younger generation is the one that's going to propel the digital health economy forward. And I know you've invested in diagnostic companies in the past.
Yes.
What did you think of this data?
Oh,
it was interesting.
Gosh.
I mean, obviously you mentioned COVID and people that has a huge adoption for COVID-19 testing. 70% report that they would prefer to do that virtually, but very low adoption on other diagnostics like sexually transmitted disease testing, fertility, hormones, genetic testing. What's your take there?
Okay. I have so many thoughts on this. This could be like its own episode. Okay. So first of all, let's think about the COVID test versus all the other tests that were referred to in the study. So genetic tests, which are generally like a spit test, STI test, fertility test, hormone test, which are generally a finger prick test. A couple of key differences that I think do drive the adoption of COVID versus these other tests, that if we could better innovate on the other tests, I think we could see wider adoption. So we have pricing. A COVID test is what, $10?
Yeah.
Right? I think a 23andMe test is $199. A lot of these hormone tests are at least $100. So we have 10x pricing here. We also have instant results. So with a COVID test, you get a result right away. Yep. All these other tests, you have to ship a sample back to a lab. So like logistically, it's hard.
Yeah. And people like, by the way, put aside, yes, you need immediately for COVID, but people like real-time feedback in life, right? Like product engagement 101 would tell you like real-time results. Yeah, exactly. In anything you do. Yeah.
And then like, you know, swabbing your nose isn't that bad, but have you ever taken one of the finger prick tests?
I have in a demo.
It's not easy and it's not fun. And you have to prick several fingers, especially if they need like 8 drops. It really is not that pleasant. And so I think that also makes it harder. Also, spitting in a tube is not that easy. You have to not drink or eat for 30 minutes. So I think that's another issue. But okay, so the other thing I wanted to touch upon on this one is, you know, genetic testing at 13%. At first I was like, okay, that's low, because most people could actually benefit. Like the actual addressable market is quite large in a genetic test field. However, you have to consider that a genetic test is something that has to be done once, right? So right now we're at 13%, but if the year before was 10%, if the year before was 8%, then perhaps we've just kind of gotten to saturation with that sort of test. The one that really seemed low to me, and I couldn't, thinking about it more and more, I was like, this really is should be higher. And it, to me, means that there's a lot of room for innovation, is the STI test.
Oh, totally. Totally.
Right?
Yeah.
Because that test, like, in terms of a test, has to be cheaper and easier than the status quo of going to a clinic. Plus, for STI, there's just the stigma around being at a clinic.
Yeah.
So that one, you would think that there should be wider adoption. And to me, that just means that there's a tremendous amount of room for innovation.
We'll be right back after the break.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Talking about testing, the FDA approved the first over-the-counter continuous glucose monitor without a prescription. So this is from Dexcom, one of the largest publicly traded healthcare companies. Correct me if I'm wrong, isn't it like huge? Okay.
Yeah.
So this new product is called the Stelo, and it's going to hit the market this summer. And it's aimed at adults who are simply curious about how diet and exercise impacts their blood sugar levels. It's a wearable sensor worn on the back of the upper arm, and it delivers glucose readings 24/7 to your phone. Would you wear something like this? Are you interested in a product like this?
I think this the Dexcom product's really interesting. I think there is definitely a population of people who will use this, and this is obviously for non-diabetics, right? This is for people who are just curious, as you said, about how diet and exercise impact their blood sugar level. I think what I'm really interested in is, we talked about the GLP-1s, right? We've talked about them a couple times on this podcast. I wonder whether this might be kind of I'm going to use the wrong word, but you know, a prior auth type move, where before you do the GLP-1s, should you be wearing a Dexcom, right?
Oh,
to really monitor your intake, monitor your exercise, see if you can behavior change your way out of sort of like the curve to obesity before we prescribe you a high cost drug. I think it's interesting. I'm curious to see if this is just going to be a functional fitness group, or if this is going to expand into the sort of the broader mainstream of the population. What about you? Would you wear this?
Yeah. So it's funny, because I'm a late adopter to like the quantified self movement, right?
Yeah.
It's been around for a while. Like, look, I lived in the Bay Area for 9 years, and that's really was like a very strong group of folks there. And I still wasn't involved in it.
Yeah.
But I did just get an Oura Ring a few weeks ago, and it's been awesome, because I'm now like quantifying my sleep. And so I am now, like, it's gamified it for me, so that I'm doing more to ensure that I get a better sleep score. And I don't know how long the novelty will last, and if it's something I'll wear for years. But for now, I'm like trying to create a better environment for my sleep so that I get a better sleep score, which we know how sleep impacts health. I think I would try this, as long as it wasn't too uncomfortable. Maybe after it's out for a while and we get some user reviews.
Your friends are using it. Okay.
I'm curious to try it. I'm curious if it would just help me understand. I have a sweet tooth. I'm eating sugary things like all the time. And I wonder if it would help me just regulate a little bit more if I knew how it was impacting my body. So in the Bessemer report, you guys' 2024 predictions report, you guys had something about the quantified self longevity.
Oh, yeah, no, for sure. No, we're investors in Rupa Health and other investors. Yeah, we believe. It's not that I'm not a believer. Listen, I think that's one of the things that venture capitalists or can make a mistake. If they're not users of it, they don't invest the market. That's not the case. I mean, there's no doubt that the data, as you said, this has been around for a long time. And I think, frankly, there might be something generational about it. It's clearly much more moving more mainstream. How mainstream is the question I have. Frankly, it's probably correlated to the fact that a younger generation doesn't have primary care docs, right?
Yeah.
And so thinking that you can self-manage, which isn't wrong. Like the issue is not primary care versus self-management. The issue is no management, right? Mm. Like it always mystifies me when my friends were young and say, I haven't had an annual wellness checkup. And by the way, I think you could probably do a lot of it yourself through quantified self, as you said. So I think that to me is, that's a positive. But I'm just curious how mainstream this stuff moves.
We should be celebrating that there's perhaps a better focus on health and wellness. Other things, like there's less drinking of younger people now.
Totally.
And more mocktails on
menus.
You know,
everywhere
on the menus
now.
And that's something, I think that's something to celebrate.
Yep. Absolutely. Cool. Speaking of trying to address the access issue, which is one of the issues that we need to solve for to improve healthcare, which is what this podcast is all about. There was an interesting analysis that was put out this past month on the evolving role of nurse practitioners as entrepreneurs. This report looked at LinkedIn and close to 50,000 profiles, focusing on those nurse practitioners who've moved into business ownership in the form of either having a founder or owner title, which I thought was a really interesting, way to cut the analysis. And they found a sort of a clear correlation between states that allow nurse practitioners to practice independently and autonomously, where they have lower population densities and where, frankly, there's a lower ratio of physicians per capita, where there's an access issue, there's unmet medical needs, that in those states that actually tend to be rural, say like a Montana, which is, I think, is the highest state for NP entrepreneurship, those states, NPs are more likely to become entrepreneurs than in states like New York or New Jersey or other states where they might have more restrictive, frankly, regulatory rules around nurse practitioners operating. I think it's just, by the way, these companies, I don't know if you have companies in the mental health space, but one of the huge issues in mental health, the great side is there's been a rise in the realization that mental health is a real medical issue, which we know over the last decade, and a real real prioritization of spending in that area from the port of employers and payers. The challenge is now there's a real access issue in terms of, actual mental health practitioners and psychiatrists and others. And so I think the rise of nurse practitioners starting their own businesses, I love this. This actually was the coolest thing I saw this month.
Yeah.
So what's your take? And do you have any concerns? Do you have any concerns from this increasing trend?
Yeah. So, I love seeing clinicians involved in the entrepreneurial ecosystem. I think they bring just a super great perspective and they came to medicine to help people, right? So they're coming to really serve patients. And actually, one of my good friends is a nurse practitioner turned entrepreneur. Her name is Claire O'Brien, and she started a company that basically, it's called Skin Click, and they're in maybe 15 states now, but they come to your house to give you like Botox and other aesthetic treatments. They made about $20 million last year. Which was double the year before. Yeah.
Wow.
Double the year before. This year, they're going to double again. They're growing like crazy. She runs it with another clinician turned entrepreneur. So one thing I also really love about it is that we know NPs are more likely to be women. So this is the path for women founders than like, hallelujah, let's see more of this.
The diversity thing was one of the first things I thought of too, in terms of the, promoting more women entrepreneurs and women CEOs, women business owners. I also think the regional diversity, frankly, right? We talked last time when we were talking about the news, sometimes tend to focus on Boston, New York, Silicon Valley, and there's, a huge swath of the country that the most people don't live there, right? And so I think the idea that, you're not only providing access in rural areas like North Dakota or Montana or what have you, pick your state, but you're also like creating entrepreneurship in those areas. Like, that's awesome. I don't know. Yeah. It feels like it's, I know we're going to talk about another issue of regulatory sort of policy, but it feels like, why wouldn't, like, honestly, a lot of NPs can do a lot of what doctors can do. And the idea that, and we should be clear about what they can do and what they can't do, right? But for the things they can do, why do we have to have doctor oversight? I mean, it just feels very, What's the word?
Inefficient.
Yeah, but also sort of like old school, like, you know, this
paternalistic.
Thank you. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Let people operate at the top of their license.
Yeah.
That's the only way we're going to get more efficiency in the healthcare system.
Yeah.
So, okay. On to healthcare efficiency. This one I heard from my regulatory go-to expert, Lucia Savage, who's at Omada Health. So it's about a lawsuit that was recently filed against the state of New Jersey challenging its out-of-state telehealth licensing law. So New Jersey has been one of those states where traditionally it's been really hard to treat patients virtually. Their law is set up that patients have to meet a doctor in person before receiving any treatment.
Ugh.
This was waived during COVID, but it came back and people really aren't happy about it. So research shows that expanding out of state telehealth services is associated with positive health outcomes, as you could imagine. And it really especially benefits patients with cancer, rural residents, and those who kind of live near the state borders. So anyhow, a minor in New Jersey is actually the one who filed this report. It's a cancer patient who was not able to receive the care outside of New Jersey over the last year. And according to the plaintiffs, the New Jersey telehealth laws are restricting access to these other providers, which violates a clause I didn't know about, but it's called the Dormant Commerce Clause, which is set up to avoid undue administrative and financial burden on physicians. Mm. So this is a law that says, like, you can't create laws that unfairly puts your state, another state, at a disadvantage. So anyhow, what do you this make about it? So it's hard to follow this.
This is why I love doing this. I did not know this. So when you sort of put this out there, we're going to talk about it. I can't tell you how this drives me crazy. And by the way, New Jersey is not the only state, right?
No.
The fact that you have a doctor who's got their degree, gone through licensing, credentialing in one state, can't practice in another state. Yeah. I mean, talk about, I'll just be honest, talk about unions,
archaic.
Doctors' unions and archaic, working to protect, this vested interest. I really hope that the patient here, the plaintiff, wins the case, because this just seems so out to lunch, so out to date. And I'll tell you, I have a portfolio company, Folks Health, which you probably know, right? That focuses on treating LGBTQ community, right? Which is to talk about a population that has been marginalized, underserved, discriminated against for so many years. And frankly, some of these state licensing laws are being used in really perverse ways to prevent folks from accessing this care virtually, which is the mode that not
how
always.
So? What is, what, how
they're
so?
Basically saying that you need to see a doctor first before you can, use Folks. Right. And this is happening real time in Florida. If you want to try to limit care, guess what you do? You try to make people see people in person first versus virtual. And that's just one example. But I really worry that these laws, which I understand have a point, each state regulates healthcare. But honestly, I mean, for certain conditions, as we talked about before, we know virtual care can work. And why limit that based on where the doctor is? It's just ridiculous. And by the way, it's a huge tax on our companies. They have to do this whole process to get credentialed in each state.
And tax on innovation. And ultimately, it's the patients who are going to lose the most are those that have a rare condition, something that a lot of their local doctors haven't seen yet, but they're going to be stuck with care locally if they're not able to see the person who's the expert in XYZ,
right,
which is five states over.
Right.
And who is that protecting?
Yeah.
It's silly.
It's protecting the doctors' associations in those states is my view.
And
that's, again, at the end of the day, people going, and I do believe doctors going to medicine because they could do other things. They're really talented people to do well. But this is like a policy, I think, that's not doing well.
Well, so you have one more for us.
Oh, yeah.
And it's also government related.
Well, yeah, but this is actually, last it's funny. Maybe we were a little prescient in our discussion last time when we did last month's news. We talked about one of the challenges. You and I are huge believers in value-based care. We talked about one of the challenges being, how do you finance these models, right? Because there's a huge investment you need to make up front, and ultimately you don't reap the benefit till later when the outcomes are proven. And I was super excited to see that CMS launched what they're calling the ACO Primary Care Flex Model. But the whole goal is to support smaller primary care practices who want to get into value-based care. And how are they doing that? They're really targeting those practices, think smaller practices, not probably actually in rural areas, but aren't associated with a large health system where they have lower revenue from Medicare. And what they're doing is they're giving these physicians incentives to take on value-based care, patients in a value-based care construct. And how are they doing that? They're basically providing them some upfront capital, $250,000, which is not a small sum for a small doctor's group. And then in addition to, they're also providing enhanced payments for things that you do on a day-to-day basis to support increased access to care, care coordination, and other things that you would do in a value-based model. And so this is going to go live in January 2025, and they're targeting 130 different ACOs across the country is what they want to have apply to this program and ultimately accept. And so I was excited because it just was very timely to what we talked about last week. And it's exciting to see the government realizing the financing has been a real challenge. And I'm curious
to see
how this
works. And they need to do something to kind of combat the incentives that are currently aligned for just larger and larger physician groups gobbling up the small practices.
Yeah.
So it's super cool to see this. So you said they're going to select 130 new ACOs to be set up. How many patients do you think that'll be? Like about 1,000 per ACO or
I don't know.
Per
I don't
physician?
Know. I was reading through the FAQs. It wasn't clear. Yeah. I don't know. There's actually a, for those who are listening who might want to learn more, there's actually a webinar that's being put on by CMS on today's Monday. So April 4th, but I'm sure it'll be taped. So I'd encourage you to view that and learn more because they're going to get into some of the details of how it works. But I mean, you know, $250,000 up front, you know, a PMPM, a per month per member per month payment. It's unclear what it's going to be. I saw some speculation it might even be $10 per month, which would be a lot. That's going to allow for things like, you know, remote monitoring of patients or chronic care management, things that you don't necessarily get paid for on a fee for service type of way. Now you can actually afford it as a, you know, a small rural-ish doc, right?
But you're only going to be reimbursed $10 per member per month?
No. So there's three parts of the program. There's actually a base rate for like the cost of care, right? Which by the way, is not based on historical experience of your ACO an ACO in your area because you're new and there's always been an issue of like benchmarking, but it's actually going to be compared to the county that you're in's average primary care spend, which is great because it's more like, how are you comparing to the average care in your county? Which I think incents people to take this on because I presume every doctor thinks, wow, I could probably do better than the average, right? And then on top of that, so that's the base rate. That's just your, you know, the cost of providing the care. Then you're also going to get what are called PPCP payment enhancements, which are essentially these, that's this, I've heard, this is all speculation. It could be $10. We'll see what it is per month. That's going to be used to support additional resources needed to provide value-based care. And then on top of that, you're going to get this one-time sort of investment dollars, that $250,000 to support this standing up the ACO and also the administrative costs for, you know, overseeing such a model. And what I note is those, the last two, the $10 per month, if that's what it turns out to be, as well as the one-time payment, those are not going to be included in the overall cost that you report against the county average. So those are kept out of the sort of how you did at the end of the day true up, which I think is great because that is exactly what we talked about last time, right? It's like you need to finance these things to get them up and going, to do the extra things you need to do value-based care. And then let's see how those investments and your overall, the way you overall manage care, you know, what does that yield in terms of outcomes versus the county average? I think it's awesome.
Can we just give a shout out to CMS for being so cool and innovative?
Yeah. Hell yeah. Yes. But I love the fact that they're continuing to innovate
on
models, right?
They're trying.
Yeah. And it's been actually across, you know, administrations, Obama, Trump, Biden. That's good, right? That's good. And in this world where we don't have a lot of sort of, there's just a lot of ideology and politics. Like we've seen CMMI, thank you, the innovation arm, stay and continue to invest. And hopefully, we talked about this last time. Now we start to see some more specialty focused programs because that's what's going to change. That's what's going to change our system. So
that
was a tour
six.
De force. Really good month of news.
Yeah. Here's to Q2.
Here's to Q2. Here's to sunnier days my way. So
yes. All right. Bye, Steve.
Bye, Helen.
Thanks for listening to The Heart of Healthcare. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, please leave a rating and review, and don't forget to subscribe. The Heart of Healthcare is produced by Hallie Tecco and Steve Krause. The show is engineered, edited, and mixed by Kyle Moore. Visit our website, heartofhealthcarepodcast.com, for show notes and episode details.
With Chime's secure credit card, you can start improving your credit scores with everyday purchases and regular on-time payments. Get started at Chime.com/build.
The Chime Credit Builder Visa Credit Card is issued by Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. Results may vary. See Chime.com for details. Terms and conditions apply. Go to Chime.com/disclosures for details.